Warning. This story includes materials that are classified your ears only due to disturbing content. Other times we are quite silly and really just a hoot. Unless you are cleared for graphic depictions of sex, violence, or dirty words, this never happened. We were never here. It should go without saying that this is not intended for kids, but we're still saying it for their sake and for yours. We don't always play nice. You've been warned.
You've been sent here to locate the hostile personality. Manifestation of the subject's repressed urges. We use a special property of the fissure beneath Blue City called the Lacuna to erase these urges and...
You deserved it.
Everyone is briefed before our mission.
Let's say, hypothetically, you had orders to do something you think is incredibly dangerous and stupid.
But you forgot most of it.
Static. That's about all we know.
You sound lost, Agent. Strange events, meetings with specific personalities and the like are referred to as escalations.
Yes, it's bad.
Like a chess game.
Static is bad. That's what static is.
Unfortunately, we're not sure what the pieces do or how to play in any meaningful capacity.
Badness.
Things can get out of hand fast.
I will make your life intolerably painful.
The conflict. Some kind of ongoing war.
Blue City is beautiful.
Embedded spies.
In the way noir films and dusty cathedrals are beautiful.
A series of bombings.
Even the most colorful things are drab and pasty.
It stays that way.
The sky above.
Passers-by are dressed formally in styles decades behind the time.
Citizens avoid talking about the Spider-Man.
Even the cutting edge of fashion here comprises old suits and dresses.
Once they're on you, there's no shaking them.
Haven't been seen since 1985.
Either you dispatch of the HP or you eject before you end up dead.
Psychological damage.
The exhibit. A white room, 30 feet by 30 feet.
9.14 times 9.14 meters. 30 square light nanoseconds.
With baby blue wallpaper and a polished white tile floor. A large skylight issues dirty golden rays from the sky beyond.
Bits of soil are spilled here and there from someone's effort to move whatever is beneath
the blue velvet tarp to the other end of the room.
Hermita says,
Oh my god.
Its flesh graphically vaporizes into mist, leaving behind a mess of leaves, raw bloody meat, and sinews. Intertwined in a semi-human form. This is it.
Tucker One walks around the room circumspectly, heading towards the blue velvet tarp, and looks around, speaking to what used to be Tucker Two. Quite the room they've got here. Is that what you remember? And where's the flower? Under a tarp would be a strange place to keep it.
That's no flower, it says, watching Tucker carefully with a pair of wet eye stalks. You going to pull the tarp or not?
Tucker laughs uncomfortably. Huh. Oh, with flowers, we don't need them, right? I was tasked with bringing you here and seeing the exhibit. And here it is. With that, he pulls back the tarp and beholds what is beneath. Like a bad neon light, the sun flickers and goes out. And the black pitch golden tendrils of milky light surround a pulsing heart so bright it can't be directly viewed, even with shades on. There's a heightened sense of being in this place, an implacable calm, washing over Tucker as his mind floods with knowledge.
HP says, "When I was 5, I was very shy. A boy pushed me over in front of everyone during recess. His name was Jerry. I remember him. He had a chipped tooth, knobby knees. I liked Jerry. When he threw me over and called me slug girl, I had a fat little double chin. I was devastated. I didn't tell anyone what had happened. A few days later, we had a class party. I took it upon myself to serve the punch to everyone. Our teacher was thrilled and gave me each little cup with a smile. When I gave Jerry his, it had spit in it. I was laughed at him after that for years. He never knew why. It says, contemplating its origins. It stares into the light, eye stalks, unwavering. They say the astral world
pairs down into more abstract layers the deeper you go.
You start in a place a lot like our own.
We peel away all the trivialities of our day. When you get down to the bills,
drama, sexual frustration, and unconscious urges,
you find the source in the form of upturned plants, broken toys, angry goblins, you know.
Hippie shit.
These things are the pins holding down the rest of your day-to-day bullshit. Maybe enlightenment
is pulling those pins and letting your worries float away.
It philosophizes. They say that when you get down there, you can change things to affect the real world. You splash water there and someone gets caught in the rain.
You snap a few branches and a tree crushes a house.
You think you're meddling with more than just a city and the person you're targeting. Reverently, it approaches the light. A lacuna is a gap.
An unfilled space. A void.
I think your lacuna device is what you use to send me to the void I sometimes see at the end of my dream. The majority of major religions describe a void and a light. If this is the void, what is the light? Tucker gazes directly into the light as he takes in the HP's words, unable to resist the siren call of the possibility of truth in such a mutable world. He nearly opens his mouth to speculate on the HP's question before choosing to instead search for the answer in the light. Tucker sees and unsees the true nature of the Blue City. Personalities run through it like a system of nerves, some specialized to feel pleasure or pressure, while others know only pain. It's like the personalities are the taste buds of a big concrete tongue. And Tucker realizes all too late that the city has developed a taste for him and his fellow agents. All serve their purpose within Blue City. All are shaped by its wants. In this state of mind, Tucker can see that even as he learns to influence Blue City, it learns to influence him. Tendrils of it reach through him, an unsuspecting avatar, into the world beyond. Its goals are vague, if any. Maybe it acts instinctively as a networked beast, feeling around mindlessly, aimlessly, manipulating everything that comes into contact with it like a knee-jerk reflex or a virus. If there is intelligence behind that, it may harbor any sort of purpose, however petty or lofty its intentions. With its resources, it would be unfathomably powerful. A fissure grows between this world and another. Tucker feels pressure he cannot relieve, stinging and stabbing sensations in his inner elbow, face, and legs. A fast-paced, rhythmical beeping assaults his ears from everywhere at once. Neither go away no matter what he does. Whether he cups his hands over his ears or he tears his clothes off, the constant assault on his senses persists. It's difficult to hear himself talk over the ruckus, and the discomfort makes it hard not to flinch and shift to relieve it. Tucker finds his perspective to be some 12 feet above the circle of high-tech beds. From here, there is a definite, purposeful separation between the central theater and the surrounding equipment. Although it's only a trick of the light and a matter of a few feet, the room had seemed much larger when Tucker was at ground level. Not far beyond is the wall, dominated by a one-way glass window, reflecting back the circle from a more skewed perspective. They've got 10 computer consoles spread throughout the room. This phase of the operation, there are 4 technicians in the room, some sort of uniformed doctor or medic, and Instructor Snyder sits in the center of the slabs on the edge of a fold-out metal chair. The man sternly eyes the wall, elbows firmly on his knees as he leans forward to rest his chin. Each bed is labeled with a small black-lettered placard, names that can be easily read. Barker, Shields, Seals, Chaffer. EKGs beep frantically, warning bells occasionally ringing out as the agent's life signs deteriorate. Worry creases Snyder's brow. Tucker faintly stirs, his body unmoving and his breathing steady, but his eyes are rapidly darting back and forth beneath their lids. Tucker finds himself floating above himself. This has to be some kind of a trick or a nested dream, though I can read the names. Or do I just think I can? He checks for the slab bearing his own name as if to prove he exists. After the initial shock of appearing in the slab room wears off, he begins to think about how to determine if it's real or not. The first thing that comes to mind is knowledge. If he can find something in the facility that he doesn't know, but then verify when he wakes up, that would verify that this place was real. Can I move? Can I touch things? Can I pass through? He wonders, and tries to move some combination of what he remembers to be swaying motions and simply willing himself towards the other side of the wall. As he does this, he looks around for Hermietta. One of the technicians checks Tucker's vitals. A few feet away, at the head of the circle and turned away from the other beds, the subject begins to whisper. The technician starts before approaching the subject cautiously. Tucker's eyes slow to a stop, as does his breathing. The alarms go off, but before a technician can react, his breathing resumes and his eyes begin a new flurry of movement. It's unclear whether the technician is alarmed or relieved by this. Tucker tries to locate some small, inconsequential object and manipulate it. A pen, perhaps, first with his hands, if he still has a tangible form, and with the force of his mind otherwise. "Don't look in her eyes," Snyder says to the tech, rising from his seat. He approaches Tucker. "Get Beta on the horn, locate Tucker." With a quick flick of his wrist, he checks his watch. "Anybody know where we are in escalations?" A short, somewhat greasy-looking tech gives a thumbs up from his console. Beta has Tucker visiting the zoo. They can't get a fix on him. At least two other agents are there. We've also got a more anomalous signal. Another tech rushes in from a heretofore unseen doorway. "We're somewhere in the mid-teens on escalations. We can't get a better fix. The last few ripples we've detected have been centered around the zoo." The medic pipes up. "We need to get them out of there. The agents are starting to show flu symptoms. Seal says the chills, Barker is having breathing troubles, and Tucker is running a fever of 101. Tucker finds that his viewpoint can be changed, but he seems unable to leave the room or peer through the walls like a ghost. What he can do is attempt to interact with things in the room, talk to himself, and change his vantage point to get more details on a specific aspect of his surroundings. As for notable information, the clock in the wall reads 3:01 p.m. One of the techs in the corner is browsing porn, mostly amateur bikini pictures. The tech who just rushed in from outside the room has a badge that says Walker. There's a blue pen and a paper clip on the floor behind one of the filing cabinets that can only be seen from overhead, or from standing on top of a chair and looking down. It's covered in dust. Snyder says, "Negative. I think Tucker's made it to the exhibit. We'll know for sure if his location goes from deep blue to black. Last time we had these agents inserted, they took out the HP and flew the coop. Haven't even escalated past 16, if what I read from the report is correct. They need to ride this one out. On the last mission, we botched insertion and put three agents in a coma. One of them has yet to recover," replies the medic. "That's enough out of you, Mender," Snyder growls. Tucker jerks his head after the last statement. Pure coincidence. He couldn't be reacting to external stimuli. Tucker reaches out for the paperclip and sees if he can feel it, move it, carry it, or otherwise interact with it. Are the agent's city cells proper reflections of their real bodies? The tech browsing porn in the corner blinks the screens and switches over to another station, alerted by a small, erratically blinking red light. Agent Snyder, we've got another open line. Here's the feed," says the tech, pushing up a slider.
"Sorry to be calling, but I'm looking for... there. His name is Giles... to have a word with him. If you could please let me... be most grateful. It's on the matter that brought him to the attention of the Domingo... wish to have this information."
A second voice fades in.
"This is Corey."
"Who the hell's Corey? I want transcripts of all intercepted calls." "Prisoners," Seals mutters.
Is this his first dive? How does he even know that? Says Snyder. The line spews static.
Please, I can barely...
The tech intercepting the call looks back up from what he was doing. We've verified. That's Chaffer and Shields on the line. Tucker finds that he cannot interact with any of the objects. Upon closer inspection, he and his fellow agents are strapped to the beds in their hospital smocks with thin sheets pulled over them. They're the same people, but with worse complexions, more body fat, and scars unseen on the other side. Look even closer, Tucker can detect a faint aura floating along with each body, in the form of their more perfect selves in their dapper black suits. Alarmingly, Barker's aura is that of a man with his throat sliced from one side to the other, the gore drenching him from the neck down. His BPM is merely elevated, nowhere near what Tucker's had been last mission. If only Tucker knew a little more about the medical side of things, he could tell why some of this medical equipment indicates Barker's in danger, while other readings indicate what appear to be mild, non-serious issues. After several moments of struggling with the other side, Tucker realizes that he is still here too. He looks over at the hostile personality. So this is the light. Where are you?
It replies, whatever you think of as the light is probably wrong. Enlightenment doesn't come in one day. It takes a lifetime. Or lifetimes. What you're getting is a drop in the pond. Am I the only one seeing that operating room? Is this what rehabilitation looks like? I thought you were a construct. My psychologists are something. You're a real person. So weird, it says. What I see is a network. All those people who were visiting me while I was in the cafe, they were all parts of the same person. Or thing. Whatever. All these exchanges, these weird conversations, are like probes. It might even be able to see us right now. Hell, this might be its face, or at least an eye or an ear, or even a portal. I want to touch it, but I'm afraid.
Tucker nods. Yeah, those are us. So much for being your conscience. So, you think that everyone who visited you, all the personalities, are all part of one whole? What would that even be? Some sort of Jungian collective subconscious? And are you Hermietta's remorseless, murderous side? Or all of her? The words spring unbidden from his lips. They didn't sound like himself at all. Not the one he'd become accustomed to inside the city, but as he spoke them, they felt familiar.
Jungian sounds appropriate. Many of these personalities and their roles in the city are archetypal by nature. As for me, yeah, I guess that would make me her. My shadow. I'm a killer. Tried and true. I have no sense of guilt. Only limited pity for people I've dosed. Fuck 'em, it replies.
Tucker says, so how come only you're here? Where's her ego? Or her animus? Or complexes even? Why is it you in the city alone?
It replies, I didn't say it was a direct or simple interpretation. It's only the most appropriate I can think of. It reaches forward, almost touching the heart of light, before again withdrawing its tender stalk. How about the zoo? Where are the animals? What about all those people on Earth? This is not just the collective unconscious. Maybe the lacuna isn't just the void. It's definitely not the Western ideal of good versus evil. I'm not evil myself. I'm just a concentration of all the so-called negative aspects of Hermie. I'm the change she made in herself to become a killer. I really think the whole thing started at the playground. It's my first memory. Even though Hermie remembers things before that.
Watching the HP, Tucker instinctively follows suit and reaches out towards the exhibit. Tucker is consumed by the city's godhead. Every sense is simultaneously overloaded as he is made to know the city personally. If it speaks, The words shatter him. If he is embraced, the touch dissolves him into its being. Whatever he was is nowhere to be found, and no place seems familiar. Only the very core of his being is not subsumed. That part that knows no name save I, and certainly not Agent Tucker. The air is crisp and cold. Tucker's outside, curled up in the corner of a long dark alleyway. The street lamp illuminates the sidewalk 100 feet ahead. It seems like miles from here. A woman with dark, serious eyes beckons, blue dress glistening in the lamplight. Tucker shivers involuntarily, be it from the cold or from the circumstance. He struggles to his feet and forces himself to walk towards the woman. Every step feels like dying, or a lie, or something else. A mist engulfs the street behind the lady in the blue dress. Faintly, a tide of personality shows behind the waves of roiling, boiling fog, a ground-level storm mounting behind her. Delicate fingers reach out to touch Tucker. She promises the warm embrace of a mother and the mindless peace of obliteration. Flashes of disappointed faces, sounds of violence, and the cold inside of a prison cell haunt the man who thought he was an agent as he shuffles towards his end. I will give you rest, she says, her words piercing and numbing him like poison arrows. The promise of rest strikes Tucker more as a threat that halts him dead in his tracks. As he beholds the visions, his mind burns with things remembered and things forgotten. His instincts tell him to run more than they ever had, the impulse stronger even than the need for air when you're drowning. And just like that urge, he doesn't know whether to trust it, whether it's sane, or if running would just be gasping for air underwater. Every cell in his body demands flight, but his damnable mind doesn't allow it. Feelings turn to suspicions, suspicions turn to questions, and the questions converge and lead straight to horror. One thought finally transcending the chaos that is his mind. Who am I? The words emerge from his lips unbidden, as if pulled by a force incomprehensible. The thought cannot be quashed. Who am I? He shouts at the woman in front of him, as if hurling his very soul at her. The hand lowers. You are but one of an infinity of decisions, 1,000 possible personalities, a one-time chance. Like any being, you are but a drop in a river of possibilities. You think yourself unique, unwilling to bend until you are already broken. I cannot give you answers, only another chance should the ones this life has given you prove burdensome. You have already tasted the lacuna once. Do you need it so soon again? She says, her voice soothing and numbing. It is your choices that make you who you are. You are a new being. Your slate has been cleaned. Your actions from here onward will define who you are more than any fleeting memories. Tucker is spent, his hands resting on his knees as if he were just running, but his breathing is far from labored. It's not happening at all. Then who are you? What is the light? Where is here? He flings the questions like the punches of a boxer on his last legs in the last seconds of the last round. He expected no real answer from her, but every moment he spoke was a moment he was spared. Whether from oblivion or from going back, he wasn't sure. I have no proper name. I have known you, as you are now, and as the persona that has been lost to the lacuna. To simplify, let's say that I'm the angel of the place you call Blue City. It is my duty to cleanse the guilty of their sins so that they may know peace. I am also the city's protector. The fog consumes the backdrop completely, leaving a gray wall of writhing smoke behind the lady in the blue dress. For a long time, your people have unknowingly contracted my services. Your lacuna device would not operate here without my blessing, despite the explanations your technicians delude themselves with. But you do more than merely cleanse your hostile personalities here. I see much of your comings and goings. The original purpose of your organization has been distorted by its ambitions. She takes a few steps forward, stopping short of reaching Tucker. You have not come here for my services, have you? Your questions are fair, little one, and I sympathize. Unfortunately, the man I threw into the Great Rift was not someone I knew personally. I only knew that he sunk when I threw him in, weighed down by a past he could not escape. You are what was left behind, a monster no more.
Her palm turns upwards now, the fingers splaying as light dances in her hand, Ignis Fatis moving about her palm excitedly. The light, like the void, is both a concrete thing and a representation. Again, your words do it no justice. Assume the light is the essence of Blue City, and its interactions with your own world. It is by the light you travel here. It is light that you and I are composed of as we walk through the city streets. The more light you see, the deeper the connection to Blue City, though the representation is not always so literal. The object known as the exhibit is a shrine of sorts, a way of connecting with an aspect of Blue City. I can only say that I am not the only aspect of Blue City. Do not always be so bold. I almost took you back to the Lacuna again. It would have been a grand adventure, but as before, you would not remember it when it was over. She closes her hand, extinguishing the light. It almost seems to pain her to do so. My city is under attack. I cannot directly see these adversaries, as they, like your hostile personalities, remain disguised until they are properly drawn out. Would you be willing to help me? As the lady speaks, Tucker collects himself and forces himself to stand up straight. It wasn't boldness. I just did what I must do. Besides, it seems that it's nothing I haven't been put through before. What would happen, though? Would I sink again? Would I float? By now, he's doing an odd kind of pacing, to and off the lady to circle her like he often does when talking to people he's unsure of, but not content to stand still. Maybe. Who are the adversaries, and what do they want with the city? What is the conflict? What can I do that you can't? Neither the conflict itself nor the adversaries are truly visible to me, at least not until it is too late. I cannot directly touch the personalities in such a way as to affect them. Sadly, the adversaries' agents seem to be personalities, but they aren't. They're visitors, much like yourself. They're well disguised and armed with the tools needed to slowly dismantle my city piece by piece, to take away my life. If you have not come for rest, perhaps you can help me save my city. Perhaps you can identify the adversary, or adversaries, and help me root out their agents before it is too late. Tucker brings his hand halfway to his mouth before he realizes he's not holding a cigarette. So how do I identify the adversaries and their agents? And what do I do once I spot them? Seek first their handiwork, the holes they've blasted in my city. If you are on one of your missions and an attack occurs, investigate it. Always be wary and watch the personalities carefully. Routine and ritual are very important to them. Strange as they are on their best days, you may yet find a common pattern particular to the adversary's agents. I believe your agency may have more information on these adversaries. If you share it with me, perhaps I can use my own unique perspective to shed further light on the nature of these invaders. From what little I know, these enemy agents began to appear shortly after the first of your people came to this place. Once there was a long and winding path before I could be found. Now there is a shortcut. I would be disappointed, but not surprised, if this were more than a coincidence. Tucker says, I haven't seen any of these halls. Will I know one if I see one? And if enemy agents appearing began shortly after our people arrived, are you implying that the adversaries are among our agency? She replies, the implications are there for anyone to see. Maybe they are among you. Maybe you just opened the door. These holes are demolition sites, quite literally. The adversary is bombing the city to death. Look for craters and cordoned off areas. The Spider-Men will help you covertly, but they will treat you like any agent and will not betray their association with you to your friends, even when such actions are to your detriment. Neither of us can afford to reveal to the company that you are working with me. And what do I do when I find a site? And the company knows about you? Are you enemies? Tucker asks. Find the ones that did it. Track them back to the adversary, or adversaries. Find their source, their nature, and their motive. Help me stop them before it's too late. She looks at the skin of her hand and forearms. Your company understands me as force of nature, not a being. I am the Lady in Blue. My words harm you even now. Can't you see that you are being racked by my proximity? Few survive intact enough to speak, let alone converse with me, she says, saddened at the thought. Your company fears me, for good reason, for truly I am dangerous. They cannot hope to control me. I am the one who introduced them to the Lacuna. I had only meant to help those that they sent in, those who I felt were in need. Is there anything else I should know? Please, Tucker, leave before it is too late for you. You don't want to become like Wagner, she says, stepping aside for him. Tucker silently takes his leave as he realizes the effects the lady is having upon his body.
It slithers out of the room, hosting the exhibit, light as bright as the sun pouring out from behind the room as it opens and closes the door. Its body is composed of leaves and stems connected by a system of tendons, a net holding together slabs of gleaming muscle tissue. As it approaches the crowd, a kind of mist rises from it. In short order, it vanishes among the personalities.
Greetings, junior agents. Sometimes it's difficult to decide just whose side you're really on. After all, conflicting loyalties is what the spy game is all about. Being a single agent is lonely work. So why not level up to being a double, triple, even a quadruple agent? Well, I suppose there is that little matter of what happens when someone turns against an all-knowing, all-powerful, possibly supernatural organization that has its fingers in every pie imaginable. Fingers so sticky, it's only natural that they are tapping into every account, every record, and even the deepest, darkest secrets people would only admit in the privacy of their own dreams. After all, it takes a lot of money to make a mission happen, and a lot of bribery, if not outright blackmail, to ensure nobody gets in the way. Of course, we draw the line at death threats because we can do something much, much worse. It boggles the mind as to exactly what would happen to those who mess with someone or something that has complete, total... It boggles the mind as to exactly what would happen to those who mess with someone or something that has complete, total, unfettered access to the parts of ourselves of which even we are not fully aware. I'm sure by now you're familiar with my own struggle between Lacuna and all that other stuff I collectively call reality. Though it should go without saying that I'm a company man through and through. Which means that I'm really all about one thing above all else. More and better content about dream agents infiltrating criminal minds in order to root out the darkness within, thus rehabilitating and ultimately text-omitting them. All in the name of, well, whatever our true mission really is in this life. If you've decided to dedicate yourself to that same mission, or we've used our vast resources to coerce you into doing so, you can even support this and other projects at Patreon. Join us as we expand our influence over the unsuspecting masses. You'll get access to all my classified materials and a bunch of stuff I made up, because let's be honest, it's all the same thing, really. Discover things the public just isn't ready to know. Experience the thrill of fictionally endangering yourself on a daily basis. Enjoy a constant state of paranoia with none of the calories. Get bonuses, exclusive materials, early releases, live broadcasts, and more at patreon.com/DonFathom. That's DonFathom. We're on social stuff, too. Check it all out. We're Midnight Police on YouTube, TikTok, and X. We also have a Facebook group with the same name. We're on Threads, too, though we're not sure what it really does yet. On Instagram, we are The Midnight Police. That is The Midnight Police. Get it right. You've been warned. This week's episode was written by Don Fathom and Matt Kimmel. Today's episode was read by Don Fathom, Matt Kimmel, Tree Mac, and Ian Bloom. Production, editing, music, sound effects, pretty much everything else was by me, Don Fathom. One day I'll put all my sources in the show notes. Until then, you'll just have to guess. All content from Lacuna Part 1 Second Attempt is copyright Memento Mori Theatrics, all rights reserved and whatnot. This podcast is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 license. Quick review, agents. That means you can copy and distribute Lacuna Slow Burn as long as you refrain from changing or using it for commercial purposes and give us appropriate credit. Otherwise, we'll send the Spider-Man after you, or something even worse. Lawyers. That's all for this week, Junior Agents. There's no chance we'll show up anywhere else in your waking or dreaming life in the meantime, so anything you might notice is a complete and total coincidence.